Hey everyone, welcome back to Blessed Child Podcast. As anticipated, we have got an old guest coming back on the show. His name is Bob Capellini, and he spoke to us about his son Steve joining the Moonies in the 1970s and having an experience in Boonville. And we have the opportunity to actually talk with them both. So welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Yes, me too.
It's good to have you back, Bob. And Steve, it's an honor to have you on the show. We wanted to talk about your experience with the Moonies in 1978. And if you want to open from there, we'll explore.
Okay. Yeah, I was out looking for answers on the road. I hitchhiked across America from Miami to San Francisco. And was literally looking around like, who has the answer? And then these guys approached me at a Jack in the Box restaurant and said, we have the answer. We have a farm up in Boonville, and come up there, spend time with us. And I wasn't doing anything of value at the moment. I just got a part-time job. So I went with them, and that was their indoctrination camp in Boonville. And I didn't know it. They never said that's what it was. They didn't even use the name Unification Church or Moonies or anything else for weeks, I'd say, before they really let it on what it was, what was going on. As far as I knew, it was just a bunch of really super nice people who love to grow their own food and live out in the countryside and sing songs and support each other. I could tell it was a somehow spiritually focused, but it was all very vague and completely under the table as far as not letting me know who they were. And so I was there for several weeks, and then they moved me to another place for more hardcore indoctrination. I forget the name of that place, close by in Northern California. And then they slowly bring out the information about Moon and his background and the history of the church and who they are. And all the people around you are getting fed the information too. And they start, attrition starts happening. People start to leave, but the people who stay, that I would guess is maybe half the people. So it's quite a number, because there were hundreds of people there, started to form a bond and talk about what information they were giving us, and started to think like, oh, this is interesting. Let's find out more. And then they moved us to Berkeley. There's a big house right by the campus at UC Berkeley. And that's where I lived for the next couple months. And that's where you start doing things with them and start getting up in the morning and singing praises to Moon. And at first you're like, well, this is kind of crazy. But then you start to feel a bonding with all the other people doing the same thing. And then you start slowly to believe it, at least to allow some belief to creep in with the original doubts. And then you start doing stuff with them and for them, like selling flowers or working for them. And by just doing something that you're committing your time and effort to, you kind of convince yourself that, well, this must be true, or else why would I be doing it? And then they move you out to the road and put you in a van, and you go around the country selling flowers 14 hours a day, running yourself ragged, eating peanut butter sandwiches. And the next thing you know, you get kidnapped by your own father and deprogrammed. So that's it in a nutshell.
Oh, my gosh.
From my perspective, Renee, I think it was maybe our first trip out there to California to visit Steve after he got in the Moonies. He said he hitchhiked all the way from Miami to San Francisco. And we sort of, he called us once or twice a week on the road, so we knew he was okay. And, but then when he hung up, you know, we didn't know what happened. So when he finally got to San Francisco, and he told us about this nice group of young people that took him in, went to Boonville, I was so relieved. We hung up, my wife said, there's something wrong. I said, what's wrong? He's off the road. You know, I don't have to worry him. There's something wrong. You ladies have a sixth sense to feel things that us, most of us guys don't have. And sure enough, she was right. And we got to visit Boonville, and we were love bombed. I never was with such a group of people. It showered with us with such loving care. They couldn't do enough for us. And we didn't find out what it really was until a little later, as Steve said. It was weeks or maybe a month or two before he told us it was Moon's organization. And all I knew about Moon was, all we knew about Moon was not a good thing. And that's when we bought the book, Let Our Children Go, by Ted Patrick, who's the man who coined the word deprogramming. And he entered the picture, and he's the one we hired to get Steve out of the movies. Okay.
Okay. So, Steve, I'm so interested. You might recognize this name. And what I'm trying to do is get names and organizations out so we can kind of follow the trail better. There was a leader, Papasan Choi, who bought a 600-acre ranch near Boonville. And I'm wondering if that's the place you went or if you heard any mention of Papasan or Choi or some type of like leader that you could possibly remember.
I never heard of Papasan Choi. I think it probably was that ranch. They had. I don't think they had more than one multi-hundred acre ranch near Boonville. So I'm assuming that's where I was.
That's the one.
Yeah. Okay. And the only people I heard of that were the higher ups in California at that point were a guy named Noah, who used to be a college professor, and a guy named Durst. His last name was...
Right.
Durst, yeah.
Moses Durst.
Moses Durst, yeah. He was often around at those times, but
that
I didn't know
sense.
Papasan. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you were in that faction. It's an interesting. His name comes out quite a bit as a leader in that area. And I'm not going to say I'm a professional, but I have heard his name a lot. So that for our listeners listening, this is going to ring a bell for a very specific group of listeners. Mm-hmm. And I'll just put that information out there. That's very valuable. So interesting. And then it's really common for, so basically the structure of the Unification Church is an MLM, a multi-level marketing. What you're marketing is a dream, and what you're getting, you're recruiting members and you're selling a dream, and then you're getting profits off of them through labor trafficking. So how they sell that is by saying that you're selling the idea of the blessing, the blessing to your family, and you're getting spiritual children. So you were somebody's spiritual child. You were a goal. Somebody found you in a bathroom. What was it again? It was a restaurant.
The year? It was in a fast food restaurant.
A Jack in the Box. So somebody found you and you were a target. You were a target recruit and you were somebody's prize, really. Do you remember who recruited you? The name or
No, I don't remember those two people. It was a couple, I remember. Probably not an actual couple, but it was a man and a woman, young man, young woman, who invited me. I think they kind of dropped out of the scene pretty quickly because within those first weeks, I did get adopted or used as a recruit by somebody named Nick, who was the son, as far as I remember, of a politician, somebody, maybe a representative or somebody like that.
Wow.
From another state, I think back east. And he was very nice, very smart and well-connected. And from what I understood, his family was not super happy about him being in the Moonies since they were connected and political and everything else. And he was the one who was my sponsor or something like that. I forget if that's the word they used, but.
They would call him your spiritual father.
Father. Okay.
Yeah. That's we call them like spiritual auntie, spiritual uncle, spiritual father. So that's a really interesting bit of information. Thank you for that. And okay, so it sounds like you were recruited and then you were isolated. Your resistance was broken down and you were deeply socialized.
Right.
And once you're socialized, once all those steps are reached, then they can kind of put you back in public where you can be trafficked in plain sight.
Yeah, that's what happened.
And so that's what happened. So those are all important things to address. One of the questions somebody wanted to ask you is, what do you think was dangerous about the indoctrination process? And I think that kind of answers that. What's dangerous about that is that you can be broken down and then trafficked in plain sight.
Yeah.
Was there any other dangers that you can reflect on now that you didn't see when you were in the process?
Well, I guess being out on the road in a van 14 hours a day and not eating right. I don't know if you remember, Dad, when I came home, I was kind of a little pudgy weakling. And usually I've been in pretty good shape and jog and stay healthy. But I was just like a little blob of unhealthiness when I came back. And that seemed to happen to a lot of people in the group because it was frowned upon to try to be athletic or attractive or flirtatious or whatever the normal young people are. And so you kind of pushed in the opposite direction, pushed that away and went towards not thinking about yourself and not taking care of yourself. And so then you end up unhealthy a little bit, you know. And from what I remember, some of the women, young women, were missing their periods because they weren't going through the normal estrogen cycles. Everything gets kind of out of whack when you're in a group like that with poor nutrition. And I've read since then that one of the ways in other settings, mind control and prisoner of war settings and others, poor nutrition is part of it. And that definitely was taking place there because there were weeks and weeks would go by. We'd eat mostly peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. At night, there'd be some rice and vegetables maybe, and that was it. But it was all for the greater good. Yeah, danger for your health. Yeah.
It's so sad that you say that was in the 1978. That's the same exact thing that happened in my year in 2008. Right. Years later, we're still doing that. I have in my journal, I was also labor trafficked by the Moonies, that we would miss our periods. I have a tooth rotten out of my head. We had people becoming anemic or, you know, their skin was bursting with infections. And it's a very real thing that has long-lasting side effects. And it's a part of breaking someone down, not only mentally, but physically. You're not capable of withstanding this type of, it's torture, really. It's like psychological torture to put somebody out on the streets to sell and then not feed them. Now, I know that there are long-lasting effects of being labor trafficked like that, specifically with bone density, as well as dental health. So a lot of people that are labor trafficked have dental cavities and long-lasting effects. I know you recovered. You were only with the Moonies for about a year.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you still carry some type of damages that you incurred with them?
Now that you mention it, I have all kinds of problems with my teeth. I have to have an implant next week. This is 40 years later. I have no idea if it's actually related at all. But for many years, I have had grinding, which is not unique to the Moonies, but at night I grind my teeth, I ground them down to the point where I've had to have them build back up. And honestly, I have no idea if that's a result of the Moonies or not, but I've had that situation my whole life. Luckily for me, no lasting major physical damage was done because, like you say, it was 1 year. And I was lucky to have parents that stayed in touch with me and took a gamble and hired a crazy deprogrammer to give me. Who knows? That was the biggest danger. I think it was potential danger that luckily in this case was avoided because of that action on my parents' part. But that potential danger is, as you know, you lose years of your life, you know, giving it to somebody else under false pretenses.
Yeah.
Which is horrible.
you can never time lost. You can't get back. But, you know, you're dealing with bruxism. I've seen that on SCF. It's a stress relief, on unconscious stress relief. Who's to say if you had risk factors for that, but I'm sure spending a year in a van or however much, you know, being a victim to psychological torture and mind control like that doesn't help. I'm sure. I remember people on my team grinding their teeth down as well. And a lot of us have like serious dental issues, even in our 20s, you know, and it's we spent a year living in a van, not brushing our teeth. That wasn't a priority. And your dental injuries, you carry that with the rest of your life. You don't ever get a second pair of teeth or a third pair of teeth unless, you know, dentures or implants. Yeah. So that's a really interesting thing. I want to bring that up. We haven't really brought that up yet on this podcast. And for a second generation like me, it was a 7-year course. You do your missionary work and then you go to college, you do the 4-year CARP course, and then you become a youth leader. Was that kind of like, do you remember having an expectation for how much time you were supposed to live in the van or do missionary work or public work?
Well, I got snatched by Ted Patrick, the deprogrammer, early on. I'd only been living in the van for a month or two out in Colorado. That's where they moved me to, Denver, Colorado, Boulder, Colorado. There was yet another training after the first one in Boonville, then the next one, I forget where, then Berkeley. And then there was another one, which was in Boulder, near the campus in Boulder, Colorado, which was basically the further indoctrination for the people going out in these vans. There was another few days for us to, or a week for us to spend together and get more deeply committed before, you know, that big leap to the full on, you know, proselytizing and selling out there. So yeah, that was lucky for me. I got out before there were other plans made for me. As far as I knew, I was just going to keep doing that forever. You know, although I had heard of CARP and the other programs back in Berkeley, because there's other people on that track. There were a lot of people on the track of just working for the Moonies in some of their several businesses. Cleaning houses was one of the ones I did for a while. Shampooing carpets in restaurants. That's one of their businesses. We went around at night, you know, all night long. You do that when restaurants are closed until dawn, and then you go back to the Mooney house and sing the praises and keep going. That was another thing, sleep deprivation, which can't be good for you over the long run. You'd sleep a few hours a night and then do the whole thing over again. So, yeah, but I didn't get to the point where they were going to take me to another level beyond the selling, the proselytizing, and the menial labor. So I don't know what was in store for me next or what would have been in store for me next.
Wow. I didn't know about this carpet cleaning business. Now, just for the record, were you being paid for the labor that you were doing?
No.
Okay.
Nope.
Okay. So how did they justify bringing you to restaurants and cleaning carpets?
Well, they said this was the work for the heavenly kingdom. And this was the heavenly father's work, and everything you did and every penny you earned all went to the greater good. And it was a blessing to be able to do it. So I thought, sure, well, who wouldn't if you can use your labor? I didn't have any money to give them, so I had my labor. So I just went out every day, every night and worked. And it worked in reverse. Too, with that mindset, I felt, and maybe you had too at some of your times when you were in the group, ecstatically happy to be able to do it. You know, I felt a physical euphoria, like I'm sacrificing myself for the greater good, which is a dynamic that works in most human interactions. If you're part of a group, you're part of an army that's fighting somebody else. It's a very strong human drive to be part of the group and sacrifice yourself for the greater good. And they take advantage of that. And that's how they got me to go clean toilets and carpets and everything else.
Wow. So just for the record, they recruited you, they harbored you, they used fraudulent coercion to get you to do work, and then they pretty much just trafficked you. And they sold you a dream, a narrative that it was for world peace, I'm sure. God's kingdom.
Right.
Wow. I didn't know that you were, that there was that business as well. That's news to me.
Huh. Yeah, there's, I don't have personal experience of it, but I heard through the grapevine that there were several businesses, you know, a lot of the people, maybe it was more the case back then in the 70s or 80s. They do whatever they could do. Each person brought to the group their own background. You know, maybe one of the people at the house I was living at in Berkeley had a carpet cleaning van that he already had the equipment. So he said, why don't we do this? You know, it was all ad hoc in some sense. You know, people did whatever they could do, make any money they could, and give it all to the group.
Yeah, that group mentality. You're more powerful in the group. And I'm sure you felt that intoxicating environment. Because like as a solo person, there's not much you can do. But with 10, 20 of you combining your incomes and your labor and your time, it's powerful and it's intoxicating. And you do feel like, you could change the world. And that's like an easy way to take advantage of people's emotions, human emotions.
Exactly.
Interesting. Okay. So that was one of the questions. Another question is, do you remember any specific public or political missions? Were you ever campaigning on campus? Do you remember any type of political agenda that you were supporting?
No, nothing extraneous to the group itself. I was campus at Berkeley, but we weren't proselytizing or campaigning for any politicians. We were proselytizing for the group. We were trying to get people to come. Once again, under false pretenses, under the CARP, I forget what it stands for, college, something or other, get people to come and take part in some kind of student union activities, but really it was about getting them to come into the group.
Okay. And CARP is still going on today. Did you know that?
Really? No. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They're still, I would say colleges are one of the main recruitment sites. Because for me as a second gen, what was expected of me was I do my labor trafficking in the van for 1 to 3 years, they capped it. And then you go to a 4-year college. And while you're at the 4-year college, instead of living at like a fraternity, you live at the CARP house. And that's where you can witness to new students and get your education all in the same go. So yes, CARP is still going on. I wish I could remember what ridiculous acronym it was. I think like college, allegiant, religious, something, but it was, it's the way it's set up. Well, from my understanding is it's like an intelligence collection where they feed information into campuses. Like I think they're even, they're on Berkeley, they're in Boston U, they're in all these, really prestigious colleges, and it's an information source. It's really, I think it's more sinister than we realize. And I wish a CARP expert would come onto this show and tell us exactly how CARP works, because it's in many states, it's run by the Unification Church. It's a front group that recruits and labor traffics humans. So it's a very important organization to uncover, and maybe not in this episode, but this will lay the groundwork for maybe the future.
It's a good idea. It sounds important. Yeah. Yeah, that was because people at that age, and they've just left home, then are most vulnerable right around that time in their lives. And so the university is the perfect hunting grounds for groups like that.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they cloak themselves under the First Amendment and say freedom of religion. It doesn't matter what the religion is, if it involves selling flowers for a Korean criminal, doesn't matter because it's religion. Yeah.
So CARP is still active in the USA?
Oh, right? Yes, absolutely. It's gotten more active, I would say. Yeah, it's got its hands in many, many, many things. And it's on many, many colleges. So I know there's one in Austin, a CARP house. You call them CARP houses. That's what we call them. But basically, you know, as a second gen Unification Church member, I would look at the colleges that I was interested in going in, and then I would put my webs out and find a carp house. And you could go to any, pretty much at any major university, kind of promises like this sheltering and harboring for you, as long as you participated in the mission work and have workshops for new recruits. And it's a lot more relaxed. I think when I visited carp houses, I think people were just trying to get by, but they still did have meetings and they still got members. Maybe not as much as back in the 70s, but I mean, the organization is still running.
I see here, I looked it up, it's called the Collegiate Association for the Research of Principles.
Oh, okay. That's even more,
vague and ridiculous.
Yeah, you might remember the divine principles. It's all about the principles and the formulas.
Yeah.
So that's how they get the intellectuals.
They state that it's part of the Unification Church.
I don't think up front they do kind of the same recruitment tactics Steve experienced, where they socialize them first and break them down. And then after that's all done and they're like, hey, this great organization is actually run by the Messiah. Wink, wink.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Yeah. So that's part of the past that ties into the present. I think that's a really important topic. So thank you for talking on that. Another question that I personally had for you, Steve, was how do you feel like your worldview was impacted after leaving the Moonies?
Well, I left in a very specific way, as you know, getting kidnapped physically off of a highway and then deprogrammed. So that experience for me, it's hard to describe to someone who had gone through it. And even I've since, in recent years, come back in contact with the deprogrammer, the man who started deprogramming, Ted Patrick, and got to spend a little time with him. They made some documentary filmmakers made a movie about him, and that I was also part of. I was interviewed for, and I went to the Toronto Film Festival and was there with him at the screening and answered questions and got to talk about old times together with him. He's quite a character. And so for me, it was the way it worked, and it doesn't work that way from what I understand for most people. It was very cut and dried. I was in the Moonies. I was there for a year. I got gradually indoctrinated further in until I was fully in and selling flowers and trafficked, like you say, and believing everything that was told to me. And then I was snatched and went through the deprogramming process for 4 or 5 days, I'd say, in Denver.
Yeah.
And at one moment, Ted Patrick turned to my dad and the other people in the room and said, he's okay now, he can go home. And it was as if in that one moment, the entire mental superstructure of belief collapsed in my brain. And it was like I woke up from a dream as if someone snapped their fingers, which is documented by many people in many different circumstances. There's even a book that if you haven't read, you might be interested in, called Snapping, that's about this phenomenon of people having their brains washed, quote unquote, and then snapping out of it. And this can happen. It happens all the time. It's happened documented to many people. It's still pretty rare overall. And that's what happened to me. The deprogramming worked really, really well. It worked the way, even better than maybe Ted Patrick thought it might work. Because he was definitely flying, flying solo and off the cuff and ad hoc. And he was not a professional, not a psychologist. He just knew that people need to be told that they need to get out of these groups and get out and keep talking to them until they would change their minds. But in my case, I did snap. And in that moment, like I said, it was as if I woke up and I was not a Moonie. And I was like, then the overwhelming emotion was embarrassment for all the trouble and all the pain and all the tribulation my parents had to go through, the expense and all these people flying to Denver to get me. It was like, oh, because it was just me again saying, I did this. I saw the whole thing, how I got in, what happened to me, how I was brainwashed, And it was a very strange phenomenon to have your brain do that in a moment, literally a second, you know. And so I got very curious about that phenomenon and started reading about it and looking into the history of it and other parts of culture where people's minds were being controlled by groups and how they got out. And then I went to college and explored literature and history and trying to understand life. But I wasn't totally immune after that experience to any kind of group pressure. And actually, I never got brainwashed again by a group, but I joined a yoga community that was kind of culty, surrounded a yogi guru kind of guy. But I never dropped my guard, so to speak, like I had in the past. I just got involved and saw what happened. And basically the same thing happened there. I saw it happen to other people I knew in that group. It was a big yoga center up in Massachusetts where people lived, Kripalu Yoga, run by this guy, Indian yogi. And lovely people there. I was always attracted to people who felt like the spiritual side of life was important. And so I liked spending time with them doing yoga and such. And then one day it came out that he had screwed a bunch of the women in the group, of course. And all the people I knew there who were totally indoctrinated had given up their lives and lived there for years and worked for the group. I never did that. I just visited there. I could see them going through the same anxiety and aggravation and agony that I experienced getting out of the Moonies, because you give everything, your whole life, your time, and it ends up to be a false narrative that was being fed to you. And so they had to go through that then. Luckily, I wasn't as involved with them. So I thought to myself, well, none of these, this dynamic of someone in charge and in all of these groups seems to be a glitch in the system with the way the humans work. Doesn't seem to work very well, because it always works out not in the favor of the people in the group. And things get exposed. And underneath, I guess I should have realized way back when, as a kid back home with mom and dad watching The Wizard of Oz, because it's the cloak that reveals Oz. It's always the same case. We're all just humans, all fallible, doing the best we can. But then continually we build up these narratives that build up certain people to be somehow better, somehow different, somehow holier. But we all know it's not true. But I think people are born with an innate sense of wanting it to be true. And I still don't know why. But we are. But I've definitely passed it now. But I don't think there'll be a generation of young people born that doesn't have that susceptibility for the near future, because that's human nature. And it's built into the mammalian or the primate system of needing an alpha somebody to lead us through danger or something. I don't know. That's the way it seems to me now. So I have a very healthy dose of skepticism in my present existence. My favorite podcast is Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. It's all about how we should be skeptical about a lot of things. After leaving that period of my life where I was involved with yoga and such, I also got involved with doing massage and became a massage therapist, which I thought was very beneficial and good for people and generally healthy in a benign way. And wrote a book, Massage for Dummies, and became very well known in the massage training world and part of that whole culture, which is its own subculture, like all industries in the world, has its own followers, and thousands of people believe in the power of healing and natural health and touch. And there are many different systems of the touch where, I don't know if you've heard about reflexology, where they touch your feet and that affects different parts of your body. Mm-hmm. And acupressure and acupuncture, you push on certain points and that affects the energy in your body. That I learned over time and through study and through research with the skeptics, is just as false as all those other groups. And so I left behind my career, which luckily I have another thing to fall back on now, because I couldn't believe in that anymore either. Massage is still great, and but the structure built up around it about how it works or what it means or what it's for is a false narrative like all the other ones. And I couldn't bring myself to keep espousing it and teaching it and pretending like the point on your ankle really did affect your uterus or whatever. And so life has been a constant cycle of going up and down and believing in something and seeing how it is not necessary to believe in and really is a false belief in the long run. And so, yeah, I was always one of those people that wanted and needed to believe in something. A lot of people don't have that need. They just feel like life is pretty straightforward. Get up in the morning, make a living, go home, enjoy your life. But for those people who feel drawn to explore more and find out what the meaning is, I think often, if you're lucky, you get to the point of realizing the layers of false meaning that are given to us as easy answers. You know, the true answer is that it's much, much more complicated and much more difficult to fully understand, and nobody truly fully understands. We're in the process of trying to understand. That's what education and research and science really is, our human exploration of what the truth ultimately is. So that's where I am now.
Wow, I love that. For the listener, remember Steve is the author of Massage for Dummies.
Yes.
Yeah, this is a very special guest, but I think what you're describing is that humans are creatures of compartmentalization. That's something I noticed as a kid, even, you know, with basic education, we split things up into science and math and reading. And in doing so, we limit things down to one factor, and then we look into it for truth, right? So what you were doing with massage was, yeah, you debunked it, right? But because it wasn't all the truth it was espousing itself to be, the narrative. We give things such big narrative and just focus on one thing when really you have to look at, like you said, the bigger picture. It's way more complex than we can even begin to understand. I love massage. I think there's something very powerful in reaching, like, it's a somatic therapy where you're stimulating your body and it's holding memories that your body has done, but it's not the absolute truth. And I think that's where we mess up, is we find a truth and then we make it absolutely true.
Right. We create a narrative around it so that it makes sense in all different ways. And so, yeah, we found the answer.
Yeah. The formula, I think that's, and that's how the Moonies got a lot of intellectuals, the formula for happiness, the formula for the universe, the divine principles, the principles of creation, all these is where we trip up. And it's because we're a creature of narrative, really. And that's, that's something we talked about with a previous guest, Kathleen. And she was a word wizard, and she kind of helped me understand that humankind is we're susceptible to false narratives.
If you're familiar with that book, Sapiens, it's been very popular in the past few years, a bestseller. He describes that in the book. It's Sapiens, A Brief History of Mankind or something. It's about the human race overall. And his basic concept, main conceit, is that humans are who they are because of our ability to create narratives, all of which are false. Because when you look to the underneath it all, behind the wizard's curtain, there is no country. We're making it up. There's just the earth with a bunch of primates on it doing stuff together. And so we make up the concept of a country, of what it is, what it stands for. We make up money. It's an agreement between people that we trade back and forth and are willing to shoot and die, shoot and kill people for. And so most of the systems that we've created are a fabrication, and that we all agree on 100%. And so in that sense, everybody's in the cult to a certain degree, are living in society. It necessitates a certain belief in a shared delusion or a shared agreement upon a set of values that maybe is not ultimately true, if you could scientifically. Yeah. And I went to another step. I wrote the Massage for Dummies, but then what kind of got me out of that whole world, that industry, I wrote another book called Touchy Subjects, which when the people that I used to work with and train and train with and teach, they read that one and they were not too happy because it explored what was really going on behind the scenes instead of just cheerleading for the industry. And I think it's a much more fun book, but not good for your career. Touchy Subjects.
That's amazing. You just became like, that's hero status, that you could publish something like that and then go back and be like, actually, I escaped a cult and I see the flaws and I'm a skeptic. I feel like, escaping a cult kind of changes somebody, where you're always looking for, you know, I see this a lot, where we're looking for the truth, and then truth is nothing's always true.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's tricky. Yeah,
it's tricky. I really like that. Yeah. That, I think that kind of answers my next question for you. My next and final question for you was if there was anything you'd like to say to the people that are struggling to escape cults.
Who are actually in some kind of group still?
Yeah. I have a lot of my listeners are on the cusp of, really? Because I'm kind of a bridge. I'm a second gen Unification Church member. I understand the situation. But I'm also out, and kind of target audience is for people that are reintegrating into society or trying to get the courage to leave.
Mm. Well, for those people, I think if it's possible, it's important to recognize that, life has many gray areas, and it's normal to feel confused. I mean, if you talk to everybody long enough, you'll get to the part of them that's confused and doesn't know what the heck they're doing, I think. When we're born and grow up, we think our parents know all the answers, but then we pretty much figure that out, that they didn't know the answers. And then we look for movie stars or rock stars or tech stars or gurus or who know the answers. And then if you're like you or me, we find out they didn't have the answers. And I think if people are on the cusp, if they can just admit to themselves that their own questioning heart is true for all people, regardless, without exception, all humans have that same question inside themselves. And if you think someone doesn't, that's where you're causing a problem for yourself. And know that you're just like everybody else, including the people who you think are better than you, because they're not better than you. And so you have to be willing to take that step forward with the uncertainty, you know, and trust that you can do it, that there's something inside you that's strong enough to do it and keep moving forward. Because the truth is that it's true. You are as strong and as weak as everybody else. So take the first step, or continue to take the first step each day, you know, because it's a process. You know? But don't let the turkeys hold you back.
Right, Papa. Wow, that's wonderful. Yeah, that's really good advice. I'm sure somebody really needs to hear that. They have confidence in themselves. If you can have confidence in others, you can have confidence in yourself.
Yeah, it's not so much rip-roaring confidence like I can make $1 million. No, it's just confident enough to know that you're just like everybody else. Nothing special, but just as special as everybody else too. You know, this way we have prioritizing and making hierarchies amongst ourselves. That's the essence of the problem, I think. You know, each person has that inside themselves. So
that's great.
I wish them the best.
Yeah. That's great for our listeners. Thank you. I mean, that was all my questions. We kind of explored Boonville and your deprogramming, reintegrating into society and your career. and how your worldview has changed. That's all the questions I had. If you have any questions, we'll open the floor. I'll answer to the best of my ability.
Well, I'm sure your listeners already know quite a bit about your story, but I unfortunately don't. So maybe at some other point, I'll ask you some more details about your background, because I'm curious about that too.
Sure.
About growing up in it and how it was different for me, having approached it from the outside, gotten in, and then yanked out through that strong deprogramming experience, whereas you had a totally different experience. And from what I understand, most people have a different experience. It's not cut and dried, like I was in and then I was out. And for a lot of people, it's a process that's ongoing. It's full of more questions that maybe I didn't have to deal with. So maybe my example can be helpful in the sense that it kind of portrays the overall image of what's going on. There's this false narrative thing happening, and you're in it and you're out of it. But so many people like yourself are kind of half in and half out, and get back in and fall back out. And that I'm lucky not to have experienced. I'm sure it must be very difficult.
There's layers. And I really appreciate that you could bring the perspective of snapping. I think because there are people rarely, like you said, that do snap. So it's good to have a resource that there's a book like that out there. And I hope people can go into that. For me, from my experience, it was more multi-layered for sure. And it kind of felt like escaping quicksand to just get stuck in tar, you know? So, and that is because of the layers of ideology. And then there's family, and then there's socialization, and you have to escape each one of those layers. There's financial dependence and educational dependence as well. So those are all the layers I had to escape. But, you know, well, that's just a story for another day. But I appreciate the broad perspective that you can snap or you can escape in layers.
Yes, for sure. I'm glad. I hope I've been able to add to the conversation. So I appreciate talking to you today.
Yeah.
With my dad, without whom I wouldn't be here today. I could be selling flour someplace still.
Yeah, you covered it very well, Steve. Mm-hmm. I'd like to say, Renee, that our story has a very happy ending. And because we got him out, and the way we got him out was he always stayed in contact with us. We got very good advice in the beginning. Talk to your son, keep the communication path open, do not argue with him. And we didn't. In the beginning we did, and we got some good advice that stop that. You break the link and you're gone. When he got transferred to Denver, I think it was in the morning, they said, pack your bags, go. It was something like that, right, Steve?
Yeah.
And he wound up in Denver. He just, as soon as he got there, he called us, let us know where he was. A lot of families, that didn't happen. So we kept the communication link open, and that's the real reason why we got him out. We had a strong family tie. He got out, and he went, as he mentioned, he went to, back to college, got a degree in, was it literature, Steve?
Yes, creative writing and literature.
Writer, by the way. I'm bragging now, but it's true. He's a great writer. Married a beautiful girl, and he has two beautiful boys. They're young men now. And it's just everything just and also my wife was kind of shy most of her life, and she didn't like to speak in front of a lot of people. But when this happened, she and I went out and talked in public. We talked to service clubs like Rotary, spoke at churches. We had an organization called Cult Awareness Network, and she was named the Volunteer of the Year one time. And she spoke in front of a lot of people, and so that was great. And I think, speaking for myself, Steve, but I think you and I maybe are a little bit closer than a lot of fathers and sons. You're a father now, and you're probably a really appreciate what your old man went through.
Oh yeah. And with mom too, she passed away a few years ago, but she transformed this experience with me, them getting me out and having to go through that transformed her understanding. And it formed a backdrop framework for a lot of the rest of her life. And she became, went from a shy housewife to a crusader and was the head of this network and befriended people from all over the country, trying to help them, help their children. So it had repercussions beyond me, and some of which were good in that sense.
You're familiar with ICSA, right,
Renee? Yes, yes.
After Joan passed away, it was about 8 years ago now, 8 years next month. And a couple of years ago, I wanted to do something to keep her memory alive. So I called ICSA, Mike Langoni, and asked if there's some kind of a fund I could set up. So he checked with the board of directors and they came back with the idea of a scholarship fund. We now have the Joan Capellini Scholarship Fund at ICSA for people who don't have the money to attend workshops and to maybe attend conventions. So her name will live on.
That's a good thing to point out maybe to some of your listeners on the cusp. If they are interested in finding out more and meeting a whole bunch of other people who are going through something similar or did go through it, going to one of those meetings could be helpful. And if they don't have the resources, who knows, maybe my mom, Bob's wife, could help them. So that's out there.
This is true, yes. And they do, if you can't attend physically, there is virtual meetings as well.
Yes.
So all you need is access to the internet. And and now you're aware of a scholarship fund if you need assistance. So that is a very good point. Yeah. Okay. Steve, I think I'm going to start referring to you as the author of Touchy Subjects.
There you go.
And Bob, it was a pleasure to see you. If you have any further questions, I can answer them. But I don't want to take up too much of your time. I know you guys are very busy, people. And I really appreciate you coming onto this podcast to enlighten us about your experience.
Thank you. It's been great being
here. Thank you, Renee, for setting this up.
Of course.
I appreciate what you're doing too.
Of course. We'll stay in touch. I'll let you know if there's any feedback or insight after this podcast is published.
Please do.
Do that. Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye. I appreciate y'all. Thank you so much.